Welcome to PharmaTalk Radio. I'm Annalee Smith, producer of today's program and marketing manager of the Immuno-Oncology 360 program. PharmaTalk Radio is a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to the life science and patient advocacy communities. Today's program is a session focused on preclinical science from the 2017 IO360 event. Dr. Charles Drake of Columbia University Medical Center discusses sequencing of combination agents. Today I'm sitting with your regular host for PharmaTalk Radio, Valerie Bowling, who also works with the Conference Forum. Val, would you tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear and the panelists on this session?
Absolutely. This morning we're listening to a recording of a panel discussion from the Immuno-Oncology 360 program, which was held in February 2017 in New York City. This session was moderated by GSK's Dr. Axel Hoos, and joining Dr. Hoos in the discussion included Dr. Rami Ibrahim, Dr. Jill O'Donnell-Tormey, Dr. Daniel Chen, and David Woolley. And I mentioned Dr. Rami Ibrahim, and he will also be speaking at the Rational Combinations Conference this June in New York City.
This group delivers a really great perspective on trends and collaborations in the IO space.
So I will just say a few words up front. So first of all, I do concur with that notion that there is no true immune resistance for the majority of patients. There is other reasons why the immune system is not effective, but it's highly adaptable, and there are ways to get it there. And for us to figure that out is the primary task. Now, having said that, you know, we have been spending the morning listening mostly to process, not necessarily science. Dan added some science into the mix at the very tail end. And it's true, the most of what we need to do is managing the complexity of science to sort out how to best treat our patients and then come to this, you know, task or objective to shift the benefit we have given to a minority of patients still with immunotherapy towards a majority of patients. So the concept of cure has become achievable. It's a great step in the right direction, but it's still the very few patients that achieve that. There's others that have benefit, durable benefit, but the numbers are still too small. So this complexity of science, now we're translating that into complexity of process. And each talk has shown what kind of processes we could utilize to make progress in the space. We now have to find a way to bridge between them and make them work together. So we don't duplicate, we use our resources appropriately, and then ultimately solve this puzzle. So having said that, I'd like to just guide the panel through a few questions, and then I'd like to hear from the audience with questions that you might have stimulated by this discussion. So I'll get us started and ask the first obvious question. You know, you've shown that slide over and over again with the number of clinical investigations that are going on in the space. So, you know, managing that complexity of just the sheer choices to be made, what to look at, what not to look at, and who does what. Well, there are some obvious decisions that, you know, for-profit entities have to make for sheer survival, which is if you have an asset, you will test that asset, and you will test it in the most obvious fashion. So PD-1 combinations are the obvious fashion at the moment. So these trials are happening. If they're always the right trials to do is debatable, but we won't prevent that. What comes after this is really the question of, are there scientific trials that we need to do that are not serving an immediate commercial purpose, but that fill the white spots in this big picture that we want to fill? So how do we engage those companies that hold assets that can do these additional investigations? So I would like to, you know, get an opinion and, you know, an example from each one of the panelists how you're envisioning to do that. So each one of you represents a model, right? How to collaborate, how to bring partners to the table. So if you could just walk us through, what is your model as with a concrete example instead of the theory that we had just heard? And then we can take that and tie that together into potentially bridging between those examples. So why don't we start with the famous Parker Institute?
Okay, so I think the problems that we're trying to solve here are the obvious one. It's not that pharma is not collaborating, and I'll be interested to hear from them. On average, it takes a year for two companies to finalize all the agreements and the contracts and think about how are they going to co-develop the combination. So what we're trying to solve here is not to do studies that pharma was not planning on doing, but we're trying to really save the time. So one of the things that we offer is we contract with the companies separately. So now the two companies don't have to think about the 10-year plan of how those combinations or how this combination is going to be developed. So one of the things that we can offer is speed, that now we can contract with the companies and then do the combination, but we do it faster. Sometimes companies will have to prioritize the tumor types that they want to explore the combinations in. So here we can actually again step in and try to do or generate data in an indication that otherwise might not be an indication of interest because of any internal reason that this company has. A concrete example is the study that we're doing in pancreatic cancer. This is a study where we will be exploring CD40 that's being developed by a small company. We're going to combine it with a PD-1 that's obviously being developed by one of the major pharma. And then we're going to do it on a chemotherapy backbone. The data is coming from UPenn, so Bob van der Heide is really taking the lead on this. And this is the kind of examples that we want to start reproducing, which is really strong scientific rationale to why this combination can be helpful. We're going in an indication where, again, majority of the companies will stay away from, at least in the initial indications. It's very rare that you will find someone choosing pancreatic cancer as the first indication that they will go after. And then we're trying to do it quickly, leveraging some of the efficiencies that we've been successful in introducing within our six centers.
Okay. And hand the word to David and see how PACT would approach this.
So we'd approach this in two ways. As I said earlier, we're not, PACT is not going to be here to tell the field what types of trials to do, or even necessarily to do full-scale sponsorship of a full trial. The sort of two ways that we see this happening is by providing this robust biomarker development and validation and assay, standardized, harmonized assay, utility that trials can use from a variety of sources. And then the second way would be to offer, and as I said, it's a sort of modest amount to begin with, but the ability for us to co-fund some portion, probably the biomarker portion, of these kinds of studies that are not being done elsewhere. So we view ourselves as a sort of Switzerland in the middle and providing this capability. And making the results broadly available, rather than doing any specific trials, and therefore that and the fact that PACT is still getting off the ground, I don't have a specific example to talk about.
Yeah, and I would view this as a mechanism to fill gaps, right? Because we have this big wide space of questions to be answered, and we're beginning to fill patches into that space to make it more, to cover it. And there will always be gaps between patches. And PACT could be one of those that makes sure that that it becomes systematic, that the real big gaps do not exist. Jill.
Yeah, so I guess I would say very much what Rami has said. I think we've had a track record of actually probably negotiating these access to drugs from different companies and getting them to agree to have them use them in a trial that they don't sponsor. I think it obviously makes sense for them because it's a little bit, it de-risks for them. They're not actually they don't have to put money in. They can put money into the trial if they want to, but they don't have to. So I think it's certainly at an advantage there. And I think we're driven, again, from our clinical trials network, coming up with a science-based rationale of why something should come together. Since this has started, we've been doing this for a number of years now, I think the paradigm has shifted. I mean, in the beginning, it was bringing companies together when they really didn't come together easily. That certainly is not the case right now. I think more companies are collaborating much more with each other. But I think that there are still things that every company can't do. For an example, like we have an in situ vaccination trial. I think companies are a little leery about that and leery about a development path with that. So that's something we could do, you know, kind of step in, give some maybe data that would give them a little bit more confidence that this is a path forward. So I think that's important. And I think we're also looking through our scientific network to do a little bit more earlier stage things, not the low-hanging fruit, but what is really coming next? What's really just coming out of the lab? Is there some scientific, you know, preclinical data that really suggests this, and can we jumpstart it? And then we really go out and seek the companies that may have an asset. And actually, in many cases, it may be a small company, and this is a real boon to them. We're saying, we'll pay for the trial, you know, give us access to the drug. So I think that's kind of how we would review this.
So, you know, we actually looked at the cancer immunotherapy space differently. From the moment we entered into the clinic, with our first experimental immunotherapy agent, which ultimately became Tecentriq, we weren't looking at it as just developing a drug. We actually looked at it as we're trying to understand a new space in cancer immunity. And so the entire development program had actually a two-prong objective. One was to understand whether this was a drug in Tecentriq, but the second was really just to get a better understanding of human immunity. So all of our clinical trials, for example, were designed with biomarker collection from the very beginning, from the time that we were first in human. And at that same time, we really put a strong investment into developing technology platforms because we felt that it would be necessary to understand the science in humans to have the right assays. And that's not just internal assays. We worked very early on with, and continue to do, with a number of external partners. Adaptive is a nice example, NanoString, from very early in the Tecentriq development, because we want to create a platform that we then use to interrogate the biology in each of our ongoing trials. And so I think that that collaboration is really important and is present from the beginning. Now, since that time, I think we've also brought on some larger collaborative efforts. And I'll just highlight two very quickly. One is we refer to as ImCOR. So we essentially started our own cooperative group around cancer immunotherapy that allows us to collaborate with academic investigators in a different way than we usually do. And the idea there is to allow this group to live and breathe on its own, to come up with its own ideas that we hope would actually be orthogonal to the types of approaches that we're interested in internally. And so really provide a greater breadth on how to explore the science emerging in this field. And then the last one I want to bring up is actually, I think, a really special collaboration that includes Parker, CRI, and many other groups here, and that is the one around neoantigens and neoantigen algorithm development. And so what you can see is that there are many spaces in this field for strong cross-organization collaboration. And in this case, this is how many, 20, 30 members in this group? All dedicated to trying to develop better algorithms so that we can tell when a patient comes in, has their tumor sequenced, exactly what the immune system is going to see. And that's, I think, an incredibly important part of the future of cancer immunotherapy. And we have the tools to sequence these tumors today. So this is very doable. And to really get strong therapeutics that have their fundamental principles within the neoantigens, we need algorithms that can accurately do this for human patients, and that's going on. So I think that's a wonderful collaboration.
Yeah, just to add to that, I think that the whole idea of this Tesla collaboration really came from out of CRI, out of our network. We got a lot of suggestions of doing neoantigen vaccine trials. So obviously, they cost money, and all of a sudden we said, well, everybody has a different algorithm. And for us, as a not-for-profit, how do we pick? How do we know what to do? And it really said, we really need to just step back. And can we do something of really bringing the field's experts that are all working in neoantigens, and is there a way to kind of validate which algorithms work better or not so that we can have a better idea of, okay, if we want to do a neoantigen vaccine trial, maybe we're getting a better shot on goal there if we know the better algorithm that may work, or at least the kind of the guidelines of how do you select, you know, which antigen. So, I mean, I think that's another, you know, starting at one place, that's really, we really took the step back and worth working with Parker kind of developed that concept there.
Yeah. So, yeah, go ahead.
Just add one more thing. obviously one of the main purposes of a meeting like this one is networking, is for companies that have new technologies, new diagnostics, to meet with companies that have therapeutics and try to figure out ways to work together. That's another thing that we as a nonprofit organization can help with, because we are spending our time meeting with many of you, assessing the new technologies and really trying to link some what we believe is really exciting and cutting edge technology that can really help with the patient selection, and then linking this with companies that are doing the actual drug development. So that's, again, that's another area where it's not just a matter of running clinical trials. It's more about trying to act like the middleman between small companies that are struggling to have access to clinical trials or samples to validate some of their new technology, and then companies that are looking for new technologies that they can implement in their clinical trials, coming from a neutral body, given, again, that we don't have any benefit from any of those collaborations.
And is it fair to assume that the selection process, what to study and who to do it with, can work bilaterally? That means companies can come and tap into your mechanism, they can voluntarily appear at your doorstep, or you can actually approach them if you feel that what they have might be the right thing to be tested. Yeah, so this is important, so this works both ways. And the more initiative you have, the more you can utilize this process. It's fairly flexible. And again, each one of these organizations here has offered a mechanism. These mechanisms are not mutually exclusive. These mechanisms are actually to be bridged between each other and tie together a larger, more holistic opportunity to solve the puzzle or solve the problem. So you will see, as this all unfolds, we will aim to collaborate with each other to deal with the complexity of the process, not just the science, and make this as workable as possible. Now, having said that, I would like to take the examples that were just given and use it as a segue into another obvious question. You know, yes, we need systematic investigation. I think that is an opportunity that we can now tackle with the mechanisms in place. But we also need uniformity of investigation. That means if company A does its biomarker work in one way, and the same biomarker work is done by company B through a different set of assays, different set of methods, you may still get results that are not comparable. They may still not allow you to put the picture together because pieces are missing. So that kind of uniformity of investigation also needs to be created. It's hard to do because each group has invested a lot in what their way of doing things. So, you know, I'm asking the question now, how do you feel it can be best achieved that we unify the way we do our investigations? And it will have to be in increments. It won't be all happening in one swing. But we need to be willing to do it. So Rami, maybe you start us again. How do you think about, from the Parker's perspective, about unifying biomarker investigation?
Yeah, so I mean, we are spending time with the six centers really trying to understand the process for sample collection and sample analysis, and then trying to use all that learning in coming up with a recommendation, and now learning about the work that the PACT will be doing. I think the obvious evolution would be that we take all those learnings and then share them with the PACT so that we can start thinking about a broader dissemination. Right now, we're only working with six centers. That does not represent all the cancer centers in the US, but now we have another organization that's actually doing similar work but at a broader scale. So I think the whole idea is that we just need to start from someplace, share it, and then with pharma, we definitely need to make sure that they are providing input. So maybe we cannot ask companies to give us some of the confidential information or data that they have, but they can also provide input in what we are developing, so that this way, at the end, we will have a recommendation that can be adapted by anyone who wants to use it. And I mean, to Jill's point, the Tesla project that we're doing, the epitope prediction effort that we're doing with CRI, it's a good example of this, where we brought all the people together to try to come up with a standardized process for neoantigen discovery. That doesn't mean that the effort will yield the best neoantigen. Because each company is still doing their own neoantigen discovery, but we can just give a tool that shows, if you want to do neoantigen discovery, here's a process that has been validated by 30 different organizations that are very knowledgeable about the neoantigen discovery.
I think PACT offers a unique ability to do this type of a coalescing of different approaches in the field, because not only do we have the companies involved, but we have NCI and a very strong presence, we hope, from FDA at the table on this as well. So what better place to sort of bring together a lot of these different approaches, whether it's to sample collection or assay standards or analytical approaches. And it is going to be testing some of these things out. I guess the other comment I'd make is, for once, it's nice to be early, because we can listen to everything that the experiences that Rami and Jill and Dan have been through, and incorporate those into something that represents an acceptable consensus, where that's possible. You know, there's going to be cases where, for experimental reasons or whatever, people are going to want to go off in different directions. So. I'm not quite sure uniformity is maybe sometimes too strong a word, but certainly harmonization of these approaches so there's some comparability where it's merited is where I think I would hope this goes.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I mean, I think you need to incentivize the people that you're supporting under your umbrella of clinical trials to harmonize. I think there's we many years ago, when the CIC was under a different, we did a lot of assay harmonization, and you get a lot of pushback from scientists that, you know, I do my assay this way, and I know better than other people to do it, and so it's really, you know, scientists, I think it's natural, we don't like to be dictated to and say that it has to be, so I think it comes down to this fine line of the experimental questions being answered, the research questions that are being answered that allow for development of new assays, doing things different ways, and then a difference of a trial that's really on the development pathway. The more uniformity, and I think obviously biopharma is used to this more so than the academic investigator-initiated trials, I'd say. So I think I feel it is one of the hurdles in moving the field forward, because I think to be able to compare trials would actually speed things up. I mean, you don't want to wait and rely only one trial and then do the next. If we could somehow figure out how you can take, there's 1,000 trials going on, how do you gather the data from all of that in a way that is comparable so that you can make some sense out of it, and hopefully that would accelerate, you know, the discovery piece. Not an easy task. And I think it is one of the challenges in the field right now, and I don't think it's going to be easy. I think it's easy in a confined small space. If you control the sites that are doing your trials and you can have a centralized banking place and a centralized, that's probably the easiest. When you let everybody do their own thing, I think the variability, even with SOPs, I think the variability is still quite great.
You know, actually, I'm actually really torn about the unification idea. I think that you brought up some excellent reasons why it's important to have unification so that we can make heads or tails of all these studies and be able to answer our questions in a comparable fashion. But at the same time, as you talk about unification, I also am really concerned about squashing innovation. We have to all recognize we're still very early in this field. We don't actually know what assays are going to be the best assays. And by unifying, you run the risk of saying, look, let's just use this assay. We think it's pretty good. And then you essentially dumb everybody else down and you say, we're not asking this question because we're unified on the assay. And so you never get that innovation that you may still need this early in the field. And so it is a difficult problem. There are some very strong pros and cons. And, you know, one of the ways that I think we had discussed at the CIC around this was to say, you do need something to allow comparability across these trials, but you don't want to squash that innovation. And so one of the proposals we had was to say, you know what? Every trial in this space should have some common thread, right? Let's pick one assay that is reproducible that we can all use, and let's all use that across our trials. And it could be as simple as something like gene expression for, you know, interferon gamma and PD-L1 and some of the other important CD8 T cell genes that we know are reflective of anti-cancer immunity, at least CD8 T cell based anti-cancer immunity. And let's pick one lab to do that. so that all our trials can have that. And that will just be a small subset of the biomarkers you run in any given trial. So you can go ahead and run, you know, 15 different assays if you want. But at the end of the day, we can at least compare those results from that assay that are used across these trials. Now, of course, as you know, it was interesting, we discussed this, and that even with that proposal, there was very mixed perspectives on whether that's what people wanted to do. So you can sort of see the hurdle that we face around trying to both create a data set that's useful and comparable and still allow for innovation.
Yeah, very good point. And actually, we have thought about that same concern with the PACT initiative. And the way PACT is aiming to solve it is to create biomarker modules around certain topics. So for example, lymphocytic infiltration into the tumor. How do you look at that? What markers do you always want to look at? And by now, there are some basics that we know we need and everybody is doing, and harmonize that. So this is the low-hanging fruit and the harmonizable part of the story where you're not squashing innovation. But then as it goes beyond the basics, you may have to allow room for exploratory biomarker development and assay development. And that can be done in separate modules on the same subject that are not mandatory. Not everybody has to do them or can do them. But they happen in parallel and they advance our ability to, you know, make assays and markers more usable. And as they become standardized, and we know we can now take a marker that we initially consider to be exploratory, measure it reliably in every trial, then they graduate and become a basic and go from exploratory to basic and then should be harmonized. I mean, it's a process, it's a fluent process that has to start someplace. So with the basic data we want is available for comparison. And then beyond that, the field will continue to evolve and we keep adding. So that's the way we thought about it. If we can actually roll it out that way, is to be seen.
So actually, can you speak to your experience with the harmonization efforts around the ELISpot, right? With the CRI and CVC, yes. You were pioneers in trying to harmonize the ELISpot assay. But at least as someone from outside, by the time that this work was done, not everyone was, or ELISpot was not the only test that's
correct.
Being used in the clinic. Right now, everyone moved on, and now we're looking at single cell. So what are the learnings from the harmonization efforts, and do you have a sense of whether this was successful in people actually using this in their labs, or it was just a publication?
Yeah, so it's a good question. This was an effort about over 10 years with multiple harmonization panels that built on each other's results. So, you know, this worked like a ring experiment, is what we sometimes call it. So you basically take one sample in adequate quantity, you spike in antigen, so you have some target to detect, and you share that with a series of laboratories. Those laboratories all run their own assay, but the same assay, but under their own conditions, on that sample material, and ship the results back to a central place for evaluation. And what's evaluated is not only the test result of the labs, but also the method under which it was done, so the procedure. And we could weed out over time the factors that drive variability and make results uninterpretable. And I view this as a pilot experiment. You know, it happened at a time when cancer immunotherapy had not yet been successful. Most of this work was done in academic centers. It was not done in any, you know, commercial labs that are used to standardization of procedures. And the variability was substantial. It was 50% variability across the samples. You can't work with that. You can't correlate this kind of result with clinical outcomes from a trial and think you find a meaningful biomarker. It's just not going to happen. So what we did learn is that very simple parameters can drive this variability. For example, for ELISpot, make sure that the cells that are being tested are not dead, right? Because if they're dead, they can make a signal. They're there, but this is not something that most labs have done. They have just plated the cells and look for signals without knowing if the cells are dead or alive. So first message, look for viability of cells. Second message, have a standard operating procedure that allows the operator to be trained and to repeat the experiment in the same way. Even if those SOPs between labs differ, The fact that there is an SOP already changes the picture substantially. And, you know, I can go through a series of parameters that are that simple. And if you take them out of the equation, it's a harmonized effort. Even if there's no gold standard for the assay, even if the assays have their own individual protocols. So you're not stifling innovation with that, but you're enabling a field to measure one thing reliably. And now, the field has shifted since then, right? So this pilot experiment, I believe, was very successful. It provided a lot of material for thought. It has been implemented, so we actually created ELISpot harmonization guidelines that are being used in many places, certainly among the 100 plus labs that participated in the process in the first place. And then we actually had it adopted by a commercial lab for them to offer a service on the basis of the harmonization information to academic and industry partners that are seeking to use that lab. So it was a starter. And now that the field has taken off, a lot more money is invested, a lot more assays are being used, this happens on its own. So I don't expect that most of the assays that you get from a core lab will not be harmonized. There will be SOPs, there will be operator training, there will be some basic stuff that needs to be sorted out, will be done. So I'm not worried about this. I think it helped the field, you get in the right place, and now we're in a new universe.
So Axel, I'd like to share some different thoughts about the idea of harmonization. I actually find the concept a wonderful one, but in reality, I find it to be just a loaded gun. It is, people don't understand, as you described, the drivers of variability. And we don't have the right gold standard endpoints. And the example I would share is the Blueprint effort, of which we were one of the core members in this collaboration to essentially try to harmonize across PD-L1 IHC assays. Those assays, while that Blueprint test definitely was capable of characterizing the different assays that were tested, the results are completely misunderstood. So people don't even understand what the values meant at the outcome of it. And the results were not associated with the clinical results utilizing these different assays. And we recognize out of the Blueprint effort, there are biomarker assays that Blueprint showed were identical that performed like literally 180 degrees differently in the clinical trials. And so, this idea of harmonization is a nice one, but there are so many drivers of variability. And in these harmonization efforts, they tend to like to focus in on things that they can clearly measure. But there are so many variables that they can't measure that the results, it's hard to know what the harmonization results really mean. And so at the end of the day, I think what they're good at doing is characterizing certain things about different assays. But it's not really good at harmonizing. And that's the reason I find that if we want something that allows us to compare across trials, I don't think harmonization is the answer. I think we need to start to select one or more assays that are literally used, same lab across different studies. And then at least you can say, well, we've reduced as many of the variables as we can.
Yeah, and we may actually need both, given this complexity of the universe we operate in. We may need, in places where you can convince everybody to use the same lab, perfect, let's do that. It may not always happen. And so it's an evolution, and the complexity is substantial. So now, having said that, we have a few more minutes left. I would like to give the audience an opportunity to raise a few questions, if you have them, before we close.
So I have two questions. One is a scientific one, another is an economic one. First scientific question is, why are we not talking about brain cancer when it comes to immunotherapy? Because of blood-brain barrier? Because in your slide I saw pancreas, breast, lung, but no brain cancer.
Oh, you're talking about the Genentech Morpheus study?
Yeah, but in general, why are we not focusing on, why is brain cancer left out from?
So I don't think it's left out. If you're talking about GBM as a disease, I think we've published on activity for a drug like Tecentriq in a disease like GBM, and I think a number of drugs actually have ongoing phase 3s in this space. So I don't think GBM is being left out.
Okay. coming back to harmonization, I mean, coming from a pathology lab, the pre-analytical variables are so, you know, it's so difficult to get that right, because I've seen samples which come into the lab being fixed in different conditions, and coming up from India, growing up in India, that comes to economics too, because there's not, we sit here in the Western world and talk about, you know, all big things. But if you go to real places, you know, in the underdeveloped countries, this is all luxury. I mean, that also applies to the cost of the drugs, because the science is really progressing well, but nobody is talking about the economics, because out of 7 billion people, only like 700 million probably can afford many of the drugs that we are developing. So coming to the non-profit organizations like Park Institute and all of you, how are you going to solve this complex problem? Because this is going to be a big issue, that science is progressing well, but 75% of the people can't afford the drugs.
Well, it's not certainly not an easy question to resolve. We do hope that we'll achieve some stability by having a limited number of labs doing this work. And I do know that NCI is planning to put out guidelines for how samples, you know, should be collected from the different trials. Beyond that, unless you actually go out and spend the money to sponsor the sample collection directly and enforce those guidelines at all the sites, which we certainly may be able to do for the kinds of things that we're going to co-fund, I could see that occurring. Beyond that, you're right, it's just an element of variability you're going to have to deal with. But I'm not sure anybody has the answer to that.
One thing that we started looking at is, even here in the US, the access to clinical trials for minorities is not the same as access to most people. So we will initiate some work to really try to understand how can we have the majority of the population here having access to clinical trials. And depending on the learnings from this experience, we might try to expand this beyond just the US. With regards to the cost, hopefully now with all those efforts to really try to be focused and efficient in the way that we are developing combinations, I think the expectation is that the price of the combination is not going to be double the price of the monotherapy. So we will try to introduce some efficiencies here in the way that they are being developed, so that at the end it's not cost prohibitive even here in the US.
Yeah, I think healthcare economics and access is a really complicated issue. It's not one this is probably not the right panel to specifically address it, but I think the important thing is that we all recognize that there is a commitment to access. There's no point in developing game-changing, transformative therapies if patients don't actually have access. And so I think one of the things that we will see over the coming years is a continued focus to ensure that patients really get access. And those access programs vary between countries. And I think you highlighted that there are some countries where access is more difficult. But you should know that those efforts are already ongoing today. And so I think we have actually a program in Africa where there are patients that are living with cancer with really substandard, you know, quality of life. Nothing compared to what we experience in the United States. And yet, when they have HER2-positive breast cancer, they're getting access to Herceptin. And so there are ways. This is a very real problem to ensure access. And as we develop more expensive, more complicated regimens, we need to continue to keep our eye on the ball, that at the end of the day, your therapies are not useful if patients don't get access to them.
All right, so I allow one more question before we close. We are out of time.
I wish we had more time for more. But going back, I mean, I think these questions were very important to ask, and certainly we, even within the U.S., need to go back to the insurance payers to also allow increased access to clinical trials for all patients as well. But my question was more back on the harmonization. You know, even on the back end, we have, I'm lung cancer space here, we have these huge trials that are very similar in the second line setting as well as first line setting. It would be great to see a commitment to pool that data as well as pool samples to be able to harmonize some of these low-hanging fruit and allow to look across very large populations at some of these questions. Unfortunately, we're always not good about looking ahead to the future, and we forget, oh, we should have looked at the stool or something else, or at least banked more blood. But I think it would be great to see companies come together, at least on the back end, to be able to answer some of these questions. And again, I think that's pretty low-hanging fruit, and I think other groups as well as other funding mechanisms are trying to help with that, but it'd be great to see that.
Yeah, and we do agree with that. So having said this, as we are out of time, I want to thank our panelists for their presentations earlier and now for this discussion. I think the field is in a place now where it has never been before. You know, we have seen an unprecedented acceleration of the pace of investigation for immunotherapy since 2011, when it really started, under the label IO at least. And the level of collaboration continues to increase. The tools we have at our disposal are getting better and better, and our willingness to do stuff across the previously very sturdily set boundaries is also increasing. So I think we have an opportunity here to do what I said our objective is: make a minority of patients that achieves cure or long-term benefit into a majority. And I think step by step with the puzzle that we're solving here, we will get there. So I thank you all for being leaders in this and helping to drive the community. And I invite all of you to leverage the mechanisms that we're introducing here. This is an open space for all of us to use those tools. So thank you, and I think it's time for lunch.
For more information about the annual Immuno-Oncology 360 program, designed by lead advisors Dr. Axel Hoos and Dr. James Gulley, visit www.theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for joining us, listeners.